and welcome to the March 31st edition of Ukraine Without Hype. I am Anthony Bardaway, and we'll be doing this episode solo. This episode will be a news digest. A lot has happened since the last time we covered just the basic updates of what's happening in Ukraine and the region, as our last episode was an interview, and we want to try to get into that kind of format, actually, is to interchange our episodes between news digests and either an interview or some kind of special topic. So I would like to start off our news by confirming the identity of the Ukrainian soldier who was executed on video, although at the time, his actual name is not fully known. There are a few different possible options that the authorities were giving, but it was confirmed that it was Alexander Matsievsky. We talked about this situation in the episode before last, so if you'd like more information, go back and listen to that one. After his identity was confirmed, he was awarded with the title of Hero of Ukraine, and there is now a street in the city of Nizhyn in Chernihiv Oblast bearing his name. So it's nice to fully know who he was so that he can receive the proper honors, and of course, all condolences to his family and loved ones. And with that, we'll be going on to our combat update. So the fighting now has largely focused on two areas, Bakhmut, of course, and Avdiivka. The various movements have largely stalled in the other sectors of the front line. For example, the Russians near Kupiansk, after trying to make their way southward to Kupiansk, did not make any further progress and largely seems to have given up on that offensive. Not fully, of course, but they decided that, I suppose, their attentions were needed elsewhere. But yeah, so Bakhmut. The situation on the ground, according to the higher military officials, they say has been stabilized. Which seems to be the case if you're looking at the casualty counts. It seems as though the last about 2-3 days have been much slower than the fighting has been in the past, though it is still obviously very dire. The main fighting has been taking place in the northern industrial area where there are several factories. Like I went over in the introduction to our previous episode, the Russians were able to cross the flooded river that had separated the northern part of the center of the city from, you know, the northern suburbs area, residential area. And they were able to cross this river, and there has been a lot of fighting back and forth within this industrial area. Now, as has often been the case with these heavy industrial areas, these are places with much more sturdy buildings than you'll typically find. There'll be buildings that have larger cellars. Just the topography and geography of the area is like very much more, complex than it would be otherwise. Factories are difficult places to fight in, which is where most of what's happening right now is in this factory region. Meanwhile, in this southern part of the city, the Russians, after crossing the Bakhmutka River, have been trying to work their way into the city center. A lot of the reports of the fighting now are in the direction of the city hall, which is towards the southern part of downtown. The Russians were able to make their way through the more residential areas in the southern part of the city and are threatening the city center. Though, again, it seems like it has slowed a bit within this week. It's just that every time there is one of these stalls, it seems as though there could be another breakthrough moment that allows the Russians to proceed forward from there. So if you're hearing news about this stall, yes, it's nice to hear, but how long will it last? What is causing the stall? Is it just a matter of regrouping to find a more sensitive area that the Russians can attack from? Is it because they're running out of ammunition? Who knows what the situation is that would lead to the slowdown of the last few days. But if you look at the fighting on a map, it is a tightening cauldron, and there is a lot of pressure on the military to either fight out of it or to abandon the city. The correct answer is we don't know. The military leadership, of course, as we said before, tends to know what it's doing. It's still just a nail biter. Then looking at Avdiivka. Now, in a lot of our prior episodes, we've been talking about Avdiivka as this essential shooting gallery that the Ukrainians were using against the Russians. Much like Vuhledar, the Russians were doing a lot of forward assaults that seemed to not get very far and losing a lot of men in the process. However, because Russia seemed to shift a lot more of its resources to Avdiivka, along with Bakhmut, but to Avdiivka, the Russians were able to push ahead north of the city. Avdiivka, as we've gone over, is this very heavy industry suburb of Donetsk that has always been held by the Ukrainian forces, but has been something of a fortress, like directly abutting the Russian-held territory. But yeah, so they're the highway to get into Avdiivka, the north-south highway, has been something of a front line between the Ukrainian and Russian forces through most of this fighting. There have been times where the Russians were able to push further than the highway, but not able to really establish themselves on the western side. There are times where the Ukrainians were able to push them back away from the highway. This highway itself is not terribly important. It's not used much. When I went to Avdiivka immediately before this phase of the war, we could not take that highway into the city even then, because the juncture to get into Avdiivka by taking that highway was held by the Russians. So it had not been a serious artery into the city for a very long time, since before 2014. So don't think of it so much in that sense. But it is a good way of telling how close Avdiivka is to being able to have secure supply lines. Well, now the Russians were able to move further west of this highway and secure some positions around a few of the northern suburbs of Avdiivka up there, and have been able to gradually solidify this position and expand outward. Currently, they are threatening the rail line into Avdiivka, which I don't believe would still be used at this point anymore because the Russians are so close. But that was the major artery into the city, was the rail rather than the highway, and they are immediately outside of the rail line. So to the south of Avdiivka, it's still the situation like we've been describing. The Russians are not able to make any advances on the southern side, but this northern side is looking very threatening, to the point where Avdiivka is starting to become a kettle of its own, where it is being much more tightly surrounded by three sides. And because of this, there is an evacuation of the city of these municipal workers who were keeping the lights on, essentially, are being told to go. And really, there's not much left for them to take care of. Other reports have said that the situation in Avdiivka is so bad, I mean, under such heavy shelling for all this time, that it is a situation much like Bakhmut, where many of the buildings have already been damaged or destroyed. And again, like when I was in Avdiivka last, it had not recovered from the fighting of 2014. There were still quite a few buildings there that were showed signs of being destroyed by rockets and artillery fire from the Russians from way back in the day. But now the city seems to largely not be inhabitable. In the meantime, we are waiting for this spring-summer counteroffensive. There is increasing proof of tanks, APCs, all the various weapons and equipment that we have been talking about in previous episodes, reaching the front of forming new battalions and brigades and other formations in that have been able to use this. We're probably another month away from all that being ready at the earliest, it seems to me. But there's all this talk of when this counteroffensive will be. Their hand might be forced to attack early if Bakhmut becomes more difficult and Avdiivka becomes more difficult. But as it seems right now, the Ukrainian army is putting a lot of its attention into consolidating its resources for this spring, late spring, early summer offensive. Speaking of this equipment, though, the good news coming out of Slovakia, they have sent 4 MiG-29 fighter jets, and they are planning to send a bit more. And Poland has also joined in on this format in order to supply Ukraine with more fighter jets. These supplies will help tilt the balance a bit more in Ukraine's direction in the air war. The aviation battle has not been discussed as much as what's going on the ground, just because it's very difficult for any kind of aircraft to operate in Ukrainian airspace due to the fact that both sides have very effective anti-air weaponry. But either a nudge in either direction can make a big deal. And it seems as though the Polish and Slovaks, and hopefully more, will join in on this soon. Well, we really want those F-16s. It's not much to say about the F-16s as much as Ukraine has been trying to get them. It hasn't materialized yet. Looking south to Crimea, we have the U.S. Reaper drone, a surveillance drone that was flying in international airspace above international waters of the Black Sea, spying on whatever the Russians are doing in Crimea, at which point a Russian fighter pilot, did a very interesting maneuver where he got as close as he could to this U.S. drone, sprayed it with fuel, and knocked it out of the sky. Now the Russians are presenting this as a huge victory over the Americans. If you think of the stamps, for example, showing the image of the Crimean Bridge being destroyed, the Russians are putting out their own artwork of this spy drone being shot down with the same victory as the bridge. It's very silly, but it did cause a bit of an international incident that by the time of this recording has mostly died down, except for this pilot receiving an award for his bravery in the sky. And the Americans, for their part, said that this Russian pilot clearly didn't seem to know what he was doing and probably knocked it down by accident and could have easily caused himself to crash in the process, going off of the video of this event. Yeah, it was a pretty big news story for a few days, but that was some weeks ago at this point. In Russia, there seems to have been a lot of sabotage that has happened in the previous weeks. The Rostov FSB, for example, caught on fire. Rostov being the longtime hub for the organization of Russian activities in Ukraine from the earliest days of 2014. So the Rostov FSB will be a pretty busy branch of Russian security services, their version of the FBI kind of thing. So this attack was straight to the heart of the longtime enemy there. And finally, I'll say something about Belarus. Russia is threatening to deploy tactical nuclear weapons in Belarus. They are claiming that it's exactly the same as the U.S. storing its nukes in allied NATO countries. Now, you could easily argue back that the whole point of many of these nuclear agreements was to keep a lot of these nuclear weapons outside of Eastern Europe and away from Russia's borders, and they've gotten very angry whenever there was, for example, a missile defense system set up in this region that could potentially stop a Russian attack. But Russian claims are never exactly logical. This on its own sounds like a pretty big escalation, but it all comes down to, will Belarus actually join the fight? And it seems to be no. So whatever those tactical nuke deployments go there, I don't think it really changes the situation that much. Belarus is basically already a puppet state of Russia. It doesn't really have the capabilities to use any nukes on their own, though Russia isn't even claiming that it's giving it to them. It'll just be storage in Belarus. It just seems worse than it is to me. Next, I want to go down to international news, and a lot of things have been going on related to Ukraine within the international arena. So first, we have a segment here about how East Asia is relating to the Russo-Ukraine war. And the main part here is that there was a summit between the leadership of Russia and China. And just following along, not much concrete really came out of it. There were assurances that Russian-Chinese trade would continue. But for the most part, the interesting thing here, but for the most part, a lot of it seemed like it was just Putin kowtowing to the Chinese. Something of a recognition that Russia was in the inferior position here to China. That's part of why this summit I find so hard to talk about, because I want to walk away with, oh, here's our, you know, 10-point plan or whatever. But a lot of it came down to the methods of communication and various kinds of symbolism and general tone of the meeting, which is Putin's seems to have recognized that he is very much in the inferior position here and is completely reliant on China to stay solvent. And this is very much a topic that still needs a lot of exploring on our end. But my own, you know, complete going wild, shot in the dark kind of view on this is, and I'm sure many will disagree with me, is that Chinese messaging in its foreign policy has had a lot to do with the idea of bouncing back from this century of humiliation, what they call it, this era from the 19th to 20th century, where China was repeatedly preyed upon by Western powers, including Russia. But since the mid-20th century, the narrative is more of how China is standing up from this long century of humiliation. And in many ways, they've reversed a lot of the predatory actions taken by Western powers against China. They have Hong Kong back and have completely solidified their control of Hong Kong, which used to have a semi-independent system and no longer. You know, they have Macau back from the Portuguese, and they're standing up as a global power again, which they see as their right as a country. And the only country that they haven't taken revenge against really is Russia, which occupies a large part of what used to be the Chinese Empire and was treated in a very, and treated China in a very racist way, as did the rest of Europe during the era of communist relations between the Soviet Union and China. There was a lot of friction there to the point where the Friendship Treaty was seen as its own kind of humiliation. And I'm sure there's some, you know, ideological wonks deep in the Chinese state who are really loving this idea of Russia now being subservient to them. I don't know what to do with this idea. it's brewing. I don't know. Could sound complete nonsense. I'm not a China expert or anything like that, but I want to keep it in the air. Though at the same time as this summit, I just want to say there was an incident of Wagner mercenaries in the Central African Republic. They are all over the Central African Republic right now and have been for several years, where in a raid, they killed many Chinese miners. China, of course, is also deeply involved in Africa, especially as far as resource extraction goes and infrastructure, finance. It's a big deal. But the Chinese are deep into Africa, and there, I guess, there are some miners in a spot that Wagner wanted. So Wagner killed them. So during this summit, the rulers of these countries knew that this happened, and it didn't seem to derail anything, but it's a reminder that the agents of the Russian state are not going to be nice to China either. Elsewhere in East Asia, though, a interesting mirror of what happened of Russia and China having its relationship. The Prime Minister of Japan, Fumio Kishida, did give a visit to Ukraine. He physically came to Ukraine, which is not something that I certainly did not expect to happen. Prime Ministers of Japan have not been to conflict zones in probably since the time when they were the ones causing the conflicts, but he was very warmly received here. He represents something of the moderate faction of the Liberal Democratic Party in Japan that is a bit more reformist, is trying to repair relations with other parts of East Asia, especially Korea. And a lot of this is happening with the idea in mind that Japan's going to have to find a way to contain Chinese power. And the only way to that Japan can take part in that kind of containment is to make amends with, of course, Korea, and then also expand its relationships with Ukraine, for example. Next, Moldova. In our previous news digest, we talked a lot about Moldova and the potential Russian aggression that is occurring there, about how many of the protesters in Moldova are just Russians. Listen to the last episode. It's a lot to say. But there was a joint investigation from the Kyiv Independent, along with many other international news outlets, Yahoo News, Süddeutsche Zeitung, a long list, who were able to uncover these documents that showed that Russia indeed had a plan to eventually take over the Moldovan state and turn it into yet another Russian puppet. Now, again, the Russian influence with Moldova has always been extreme, but there was this plan in place. I'll leave the link in the description of this episode so you can see it for yourself. But it was all laid out that they would use pro-Russian business, oligarchic interests, try to operate more kind of spy operations out of Transnistria, to make heavy use of pro-Russian media, to spread disinformation, whole plan to take over this country. So yes, I'll be leaving that link so you can see it more for yourself. But here is one of the really big stories. Vladimir Putin is now a wanted man. The International Criminal Court, operating out of The Hague, issued an arrest warrant for Vladimir Putin for mass kidnapping, for the act of genocide, really is what it is, of Russians stealing children from territory that they take over and bringing them into Russia and adopting them out to Russian families who can then train them to be good little Russians. Again, genocidal, this is explicitly listed as an act of genocide. Everyone who takes part in it is a genocidaire and war criminal. But specifically, this went out to Putin for himself due to the fact that this does seem to be a policy directed from the very, very top, along with Maria Lvova-Belova, the Children's Rights Commissioner, a title that is seems almost mocking considering the crimes that she's guilty of. She herself did take part in holding one of these children hostage for herself. But yeah, so she and Putin are both formally wanted and are supposed to appear before court to answer these crimes. Now, the problem with this is that Russia is not part of the International Criminal Court. They don't have to listen to them at all. Neither is the US, for that matter. Neither is Ukraine, for that matter. Though Ukraine has said that it would cooperate with any investigations or prosecutions by the ICC that relate to this war, there should be a political push to make Ukraine more formally a part of the ICC, considering how much Ukrainian messaging and true diehard belief comes down to wanting to prosecute Russians for their horrible crimes that they've been doing. But that basically what I'm saying here is that it comes down to a jurisdictional problem where actually prosecuting, arresting them will be difficult. Now, any country who is party to the ICC is required to actually arrest people on these warrants. Though the prime candidate for where this could take place, South Africa, Putin is supposed to be going to a summit in South Africa in August. And according to the rules, the South African authorities are supposed to arrest him while he's there, but they said that they will not do so. They did this before. There was an arrest warrant out for President of Sudan, al-Bashir. He was wanted for taking part in the genocide in Darfur. He went to South Africa, and South Africa did not follow through with its commitments then, and they will not do so now. Though, of course, Hungary, for whatever reason, also said that they would not arrest Putin either. It's not as though Putin's going to work his way into the European Union anytime soon, physically at least. So Hungary did not have to do this. They just made a point of being as much of Russian stooges as they possibly could, as has been the case for a very long time. However, as much as I want to say that this doesn't really have a direct effect, it still does. Shortly after this announcement, Ukraine was able to get back some of these stolen children back from Russia. There was some kind of deal that happened where these Ukrainian orphans, or not even orphans in many cases, were returned to Ukraine, possibly to make it look less bad. I don't know if the Russians think that handing a small number of children back who they had already kidnapped and started the process of brainwashing, if they'll make it look less genocidal by sending some of them back, it's unknown. But this process is happening. There is proof of other networks operating within Russia to contact these children and return them to Ukraine. But this is all very hush-hush. Who knows what's happening? And the other thing I wanted to say about what these warrants can do, it means that the authorities more aggressively go after Putin's property and the property of his associates that still exists in Europe. The sanctions have already been quite extensive, but for example, Putin still owns a mansion in Switzerland, for example, through other people's names, of course, not his own name. But when you have a warrant out from the ICC, it does open up some legal avenues that were not as open before. So it can still lead to something. And to close out this international news segment, Azerbaijan has begun new hostilities, specifically in Karabakh, but also against Armenia proper. They are threatening to do so anyway. The president of Azerbaijan, Ilham Aliyev, came out and made this speech about the southern portion of Armenia, the Zangezur region, that forms a wedge between the main part of Azerbaijan and an enclave that's surrounded by Armenia and Turkey and Iran. So he's saying that this area of Armenia that's separating these two regions of Azerbaijan is fully Azerbaijani territory, and they will act to get their historical right land to. There's a whole mess in there about how Iran had made some promises to act in the case of Azerbaijan trying to gain control over the entirety of the Armenian-Iranian border. So it looks like we're at the start of a new round of hostilities, but these hostilities have come and gone many, many times since the end of the previous war there, and especially since Russia, the security guarantor in this region, has been busy with other things. We've talked about how Russian authority and influence in this region has been on the decline, and because of that, Azerbaijan has saw the opportunity to disrupt the order there. Well, of course, also acting as one of the main ways that Russia is able to get around sanctions by just diverting its goods and resources through Azerbaijan before then selling it to Europe and the rest of the world. It is not like Azerbaijan is anti-Russia or anything like that, as often as people try to portray them that way, unfortunately, especially in Ukraine, who does have a close relationship with Azerbaijan. They are playing both sides of this. But in the meantime, keep an eye out for this expanding into yet another war. And finally, to talk about domestic issues within Ukraine itself that have nothing to do with the war, or at least only tangentially. Now, as we sit here, the Russian Orthodox priests that occupy the Kyiv Church Lavra, the main site of Orthodox Christianity within Ukraine. We talked about this more on the Christmas episode, where they are basically trying to be expelled from the Kyiv Church Lavra by the state, and they are having none of it. They are told to vacate the premises. They're not doing so. They are turning away any government inspectors or law enforcement to actually see what's going on there. The priests have said that on their way out, they're basically going to steal everything. They've largely declared that to be their goal. They say it's all theirs anyway, so they'll take it with them when they go. But there have been some, not extremely violent, but we'll call them aggressive clashes between these Russian priests and law enforcement and demonstrators. It really hasn't elevated to much more than, pouring water on each other, but that could escalate. I don't know how much it can. We're talking about a bunch of old men who are laden down with jewelry of golden crosses and all that. I don't think they're the fighting type. but cracking down on them will probably be seen as a bad move on the international level. My thoughts on the Russian Orthodox Church are both obvious and explained in great detail in the past. But as it stands, they're not supposed to be there, but they're also not going to leave. How the state will get them to leave, I don't know. It probably will not be too aggressive or violent, but it has to happen eventually. I don't know. Confiscate their expensive cars. What are they going to do about it? But also that in a move that is also pissing off these priests is that a gay marriage bill has been introduced to the Ukrainian legislature. Now, gay marriage is not yet legal in Ukraine, but throughout the course of this war, I'd say there has been, at least from my perspective, a liberalization of values in a way. This war is happening supposedly because Russia is very mad about Ukraine turning towards the West and Western ideas and away from Russian ones. And as much as it's used in propaganda by Russia, it is true that that kind of worldview comes with a lot of these liberal ideas like gay marriage. It's also important to point out how many LGBT people have been fighting in the Ukrainian army to defend the country. Many have identified themselves as such. And where gay marriage specifically is very important right now is if a soldier in the Ukrainian army is debilitated or perhaps even die, the only way their partner would be able to take care of their affairs at that point is if they're actually married, not just, you know, boyfriend, boyfriend, girlfriend, girlfriend, or any other, you know, gendered category within that. And this is an important legal matter. The gay soldier gets blown up and he needs his partner to take care of his legal affairs. That needs to be an option. It's been very important to a lot of heterosexual couples, where a lot of these wartime couples were decided to make the jump into formal marriage just because that opens up many more legal options they would not have otherwise. And that becomes very important in these precarious situations like how I described. So that is an important way to push this bill forward, is that it is not just a cultural problem or issue. It is a very practical legal one that needs to be solved as soon as possible. So we'll be keeping an eye on the progress of that legislation. We talked about some of the shifts going on in the government before. Well, we have two more positions that have seen a change in leadership within the Ukrainian government, and they both look really good. Oleksandr Kamishin was the head of Ukrainian Railways through all this, and Ukrainian Railways has been a serious success story throughout all this time. The railways, when they're not, you know, directly under fire by the Russians, are being used to transport people and goods all over the place. They're running more or less on time. When Kyiv was under siege, for example, the rail system was one of the main ways people were able to escape. And I could go on and on about how great Ukrainian railways have been. They're truly heroes. All the workers there have been heroes. And a lot of that comes down to the organization of Oleksandr Kamishin, who has also really made a name for himself as a communicator. Anyway, so talking up this guy and his prior post, well, he's now going to be the head of the Ministry of Strategic Industries. This is the ministry that deals with a lot of the weapons production, as in the name, strategic industries, things that are important to the war effort to organize the various companies that work within that field. And someone who's very good at these very difficult situations and handling the logistics, all that, as he did with the trains, sounds like a perfect match. It's a promotion for him. Fantastic. The other is Oksin Lazovy. He is going to be the new education minister. Before the war, he was very heavily involved in student age STEM education, especially. He was the head of the Small Academy of Sciences of Ukraine. It is a way for young students to be able to take part in research and hold conferences and education, that kind of thing, to find the next great scientists of the country and all that. He was also a coach for a while, but during the war, he was a volunteer in the military. So he's really ticking off all the boxes for this. And on top of that, he also has a pedigree of being the son of Vasilisov, who was a Soviet dissident. So on top of all that, he kind of has, you know, the political pedigree to go along with it of, you know, freedom isn't just his family tree, I suppose. But yeah, so he is now the education minister. Part of that right now has to do with dealing with the horrible situations of trying to run an education system while schools are facing the possibility of being bombed at any time. As horrible that is to think about, it is a unique layer that other education ministries throughout the world don't always have to deal with. And as a military man, he kind of has those sensitivities of being under fire, which is very important. But then also his experience as, like I said, the small Academy of Sciences and promoting STEM education. The country needs to be rebuilt. It needs to have a very forward-thinking and progressive way of dealing with this local homegrown educational talent, especially when faced with the possibility of brain drain. A lot of people have left the country. While outside of Ukraine, they are making, you know, education and business connections outside of Ukraine. And a lot of what he'll be faced with is trying to keep smart, talented people from leaving for good, to come back when the war is over and have something waiting for them when they get here. But yeah, so these government appointments, very important. And I assume that there will be more change-ups in the government, probably in the coming months or so. There is lots happening behind the scenes. We're not seeing the end of these government shakeups. But to end this episode, I'm going to talk about something not as weighty as anything else, and that's the Oscars, and specifically the documentary category. Now, what everyone was, the competition that Ukrainians were watching during this Oscars was between the documentary Navalny, put on by Bellingcat and some others, along with a Ukrainian documentary called A House Made of Splinters, about an orphanage in Lysychansk before the war, or before this stage of the war, I should say. Of course, the setting of this movie is because a lot of these orphans were made orphaned by the war in 2014 and since then. And also the various psychological and social and all other kinds of pressures that would lead parents to have to leave their children in an orphanage in that part of the country, or any part of the country, really. Now, I watched both of these movies myself. The Navalny one was definitely more professionally produced, I'd say. A lot more money went into it, and you could definitely tell. But I feel like it kind of missed a lot of the questions that would be important about a Navalny document. Navalny being one of the leaders of the Russian opposition, he was poisoned, and the documentary is basically about finding the Russian agents who poisoned him and the work that went into doing so. He is currently in a Russian prison for being against the state. But anyway, so yeah, this movie was mostly about finding who his potential assassins would be and the investigation that went into that. Maybe just because I followed a lot of those investigations while they're happening, it did not seem as exciting and movie worthy. I don't know just how to say it. I knew what everything that was going on, which in a documentary kind of takes away from it. But anyway, a lot of the questions, more interesting things about Navalny, just weren't left out. His relationship with the far right was touched on, but he completely avoided the question. Of course, this invasion had not happened yet when the movie was being made, so they did not do that. But, you know, a lot of time passed between when they shot the movie and when this war expanded. And now that you'd think they'd add something in, you know, it just felt like a lot was left on the table there. It didn't even really do a very good job of explaining why Navalny was important, which I think would be a main thing to say about him. And on the other hand, this Ukrainian documentary I found much more heart-wrenching. It's about young orphans. It's going to be sad. That's just how it is. But it was very astute social commentary, but left a lot of that to insinuation. And they would say, some things directly, like, of course, you know, the reason why those kids were there, a lot of them were, had parents who were alcoholics or drug addicts. And they're quite explicit that a lot of the psychological pressures were because of the Russian invasion, but they didn't focus on that. It was more seeing the results, and I don't know, it was something you kind of had to pay attention to kind of work out everything. It was a style of documentary that was more slice of life, I want to say. Anyway, so that's my review of those two movies. Watch both, I suppose, but House Made of Splinters I found much more engaging. But the controversy came down to Navalny winning. A Russian winning this award, whether he's, you know, for the state, against the state, whatever stance on the state he may have, and that is not as clean as you may think. But it felt odd to have a Russian up against the Ukrainians and have the Russian win. It just felt icky on that level. And when accepting the award, because Navalny won the Oscar for documentary, they probably should have addressed that. For one of the main criticisms of Navalny is that he has had a very lukewarm stance on Ukraine. For all these years, he famously said that you can't just give Crimea back. Crimea is not a sandwich. But when that is one of your major criticisms, that you don't address Ukrainians, that you don't take them into account, at least when his family, he could not accept the award, obviously, because he's currently in prison and very likely may not survive for very long. But when his family went up to accept the award, it should have been something to do to acknowledge the Ukrainians in the room and the pain that they went through. Because again, this is Lysychansk. And if you listen, have been our listener, you know that, or following Ukraine at all, you know that Lysychansk has gone through absolute hell. And so these are people who escaped hell to be at the Oscars. And of course, there's a whole controversy over Zelensky asking to speak at the Oscars and was turned down. So this whole segment here, not that important. The Oscars themselves are not that great of an institution. I personally think that Navalny won because a lot of the ways that people do win an Oscar is because that they do these campaigns, essentially. And you need money to have these ads get their word up, which they did spend a lot of money on. So they had a much bigger campaign to get their name into the out to the voters in the Academy. While House Made of Splinters did not. And Navalny is a middle-aged white man who is seemingly very smart, but also an asshole. And that seems to be one of the main genres of movie that actually does win the Oscars. There's the movies about how much movies are good and important, and there are the movies about how middle-aged men who everyone thinks is an asshole but turns out to be right, those also win. And in both cases, it's because those are the people in the Academy. They want to see, they like movies about themselves, and they see Navalny in themselves more so than orphanage directors from Lysychansk. So that is our episode for the week. Thank you very much for listening. Again, like I said in the beginning, we're going to try to alternate, so the next episode will be some kind of special topic. And as always, if you'd like to support this podcast, the best way to do so is to just tell your friends, your family, share us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, whatever is your preferred method of communication, get the word out. If you would like more information about various charities and sources of information about Ukraine, I did make a link tree for these resources, which again will be in a link in the description there. And if you would like to financially support this podcast, please go to patreon.com/UkraineWithoutHype and donate at one of the tiers. And with that, I'd like to thank our Patreon subscribers. You are what make this podcast possible. So thank you all very much to Deborah Grazer, Will Stevens, David Shepard, Dawson, Giorgio, Ivana Kapratskaya, Michael Drucker, Anna Karen, Anonymous, Devi, Etene, Justin Devendorf, Kevin, Michael Whitman, Mike Barone, Sam Toman, Silas Frank, Theo, Adam Poppenheimer, Ada McDonnell, Alex Grochemel, Anastasia, Barbara, Big Rob, Brianna Rhoda, Captain Technical, Chris Bennington, Chris Walker, Crystal Burns, Daniel Spring, David Wall, Emily Bavona, Eric Honnold, Grace Krause, Had to Laugh, Jacob Hoem, James Wise, Jenny Louise, Jerd, Julia Lindsay, Ken Shoemaker, Kristen Swanland, Laura De Leon, Levy Grove, Lati, Marguerite, Matt Miller, Melissa Koselko. Your name here implies that you want to be anonymous, so I'll just skip over that. Thank you anyway. Noam Hart, Paul Bailey, Randy McNerlin, Sanjay, Scott Gengris, Scott Tokaryuk, Steve Bien, Stephen Greenberg, Stuart Akers, Susan Winter, T. Bart, Thomas Sobiek, Veronica, and Victoria Ligantineva. Thank you all very much. So until next week, thank you so much for listening. Slava Ukraini!